morning again.
I left me a treat here. Let me set the odds of me stepping that and slipping being broadcast to the internet are not zero. So, okay. Welcome. We are continuing our series going through the book of Romans. And we've covered a lot of ground. And now we are at the point where Paul gets very, very practical and speaks directly to the lives of the people who are hearing this letter read. And by way of like 30-second recap, because it's important to always remember where we came from, especially in the book of Romans, Paul is effectively encouraging his readers in the city of Rome, as they're a community that evidently is having a hard time getting along for multiple complicated reasons, that they live in a very privileged time. Not because of where they live. In fact, Rome was at that point and generally was kind of a sewer. But because they lived at the time where they got to see how God's faithfulness has finally come about. That in significantly more ancient times, God had made a promise to a man named Abraham that through his bloodline, he would, to put it in a very British way, put the world to rights, to bring about its redemption and reconciliation. And they not only get to be alive and see how God has been faithful to that promise over a couple thousand years, quite literally, but they get to see that it has been accomplished in a way that nobody thought he would. That he actually wrote, as the author of creation, he wrote himself into our story and occupied creation, his own creation himself, through his son. And his son became the one faithful Israelite. The history of Israel is, shall we say, not great. But Jesus, his son, took it upon himself to live that out. And as you kind of see, leading up to Jesus, God had given his commandments, his Torah, his teaching. And this was supposed to show us as human beings what it means to live and be a truly human being. And what that ended up doing is almost like drawing venom out of a wound. It kind of pulled evil to the surface. So we hear commandments like don't steal. And first off, suddenly that's the first thing I want to do. But ultimately what it reveals is the problem deep within us all. And Jesus had this remarkable ability to draw not only people who are in desperate need of grace and mercy, but also he ended up acting as a magnet for evil. And all of the evil and dark tendencies within all of us came crashing on Jesus. And Jesus did this willingly. And when he died, that died too. And then when he was raised from the dead, which nobody saw coming, it began this new era for humanity. And we, as his followers of Jesus, as Paul says in chapters like 6 and 7, we've been buried with Jesus in our baptism. We've been raised to new life, like becoming part of this new era. And one thing has been palpably missing throughout our entire time going through the book of Romans. And once I say it, I think some of you will go, oh yeah, that hasn't come up at all. And the answer, or the reason why, is that Paul has no interest in talking about it. Paul has not mentioned going to heaven. It's not on his radar at this point. Now, I'm not saying that there's no such thing as going to heaven when you die. That's not what I'm saying. There are other letters that Paul writes where he suggests that we rest with Jesus, which is by definition heaven. But that's only part of the story. Because as the story that Paul has been telling this whole time is that Jesus being raised from the dead is just the beginning. And when Jesus returns, he will finish what he started when he was raised. The promise, the ultimate promise for Christian hope is redemption and resurrection, which is much different. Because if the whole narrative arc of God's history of salvation is just to pull us up into heaven, then this is a story of escape. And I don't know about you, but every time that I have tried to escape my problems, it's made it so much worse. What God is offering by raising Jesus from the dead is the beginning of redemption. And this has actually been infused throughout Christian history. We're kind of at a weird moment in modern American Christian thought where we've kind of lost track of this a fair bit. But we're starting to wake back up, which is really, really encouraging. And in fact, there's an addition to a very familiar phrase that I would commend to all of you that has been, it has existed throughout different traditions within the Christian world. And it's oddly appropriate today for those of us who knew and remember Dave Clark, a very prominent and important member of our community. We could say, may he rest in peace and rise in glory. That he is at peace and with Jesus, and he will rise again. So that pulls us all the way up to kind of through chapter 11. And this is, and then we get into chapter 12, if you're following the math. And Paul then says, therefore, at the beginning of chapter 12, and as we talked about last week, that therefore is really important because with all of this being true about us, this will reflect in the way we live. And he begins by saying, everybody has a part to play. And as we saw last week, he constructs this or explains this in a way that would have been very subversive to a Roman audience. Whereas typically, their culture, their society is very stratified. It was all about the pursuit of power and authority. And everything you did would either be to obtain as much power and authority and status as you could, while also pushing others down and standing on top of them. But Paul, in a very subtle way, says that is not how we do things. Everybody, as part of the family of God, has a place. There is nobody who is more important than the other. We are all one body. And then, off of that, he then moves to our reading for today. And in a sense, it's very like, I don't know, it makes the Christian church sound a little bit like a hippie commune or something like that. Or I think maybe the best way to sum it up is with they're really well known in the 80s, these philosophers from the 80s called Bill and Ted. I was like, wait for it. When they said, and I quote, be excellent to each other. To be honest, that's not a bad way to summarize that. As much as it pains me to say that, no. But it's also important to know that this kind of thought did not exist in the Roman world. This is a truly unique moment in history, because the idea of loving somebody who had no family or business ties to me did not exist, period. Especially with the idea of loving and caring for the needs of those whose society would say is beneath me. None of that existed. We invented it. It's our thing. And the world will never be the same as a result. Now, we can summarize a couple of the things a little bit more concisely and maybe draw some of its meaning. And honestly, we could spend 6 weeks on just this. We're not, but we could. The first part of it would be Like, be present with each other. Be present with each other in a way that you can recognize and care for their needs. This is why he would say things like, weep with those who weep, rejoice with those who rejoice. You can't do that unless you live a life that is connected and present with each other. This is a good thing. It is kind of a unique thing, and it's absolutely unique in that moment. To actually be also invested in and looking and out for and caring for the needs of our community. I mean, imagine if we all truly, fully followed this. What would life look like? It would be different. And throughout history, there have been these communities, they're generally called churches, that have actually taken this seriously, and they have a tendency to change the world by starting very, very locally. That's part of where we are today here in Albuquerque in the year 2026. That said, I don't know if you know this, but that can be really hard. To live that present in the lives of other people. Boy, that can be tricky. I don't recall who said it, and I wasn't planning on saying it, but I might as well. I think he was a French philosopher and satirist, but don't quote me on that. But he said, hell is other people at breakfast. Which just adds a little extra flavor to it. And to an extent, there is a little bit of truth to that. People can be like sandpaper. It can be really hard to get along. And if Paul is saying, therefore, because we are now getting to witness and experience this unending, enduring faithfulness of God throughout countless generations, revealed by sending his son, writing him into our story, placing him in his own creation to redeem it and pull us together as a community, as a part of this kingdom of new creation, and then to live in a very hostile world with those values, we are going irritate each other. That's what naturally happens. And then Paul continues in a conversation about things like vengeance or revenge, what it means to interact with somebody that you would identify as your enemy. And it's not always clear to me what he means by that. I don't have enemies. To me, like, an enemy is somebody who's actively trying to kill me or something like that. I've had people in my life, and I've known people who've maybe tried to, like, undermine me or cut me down or put me in my place or something like that. And that's just kind of an unfortunate but normal part of living as a human among other humans. And so the question kind of gets raised, how do we do that? What do we as followers of Jesus who recognize that there is a new era that started by Jesus walking out of his tomb after dying a brutal death for us, what does it mean to live in and among others in that same way? Well, for starters, it means learning and going through the process of maturing to forgive those who have hurt us. I cannot speak to your specific individual experience. Learning to forgive is incredibly hard. And to quote C.S. Lewis, forgiveness is a beautiful, wonderful idea until we have something to forgive. And then it's tricky. And forgiveness, in my experience, and I'm not even for a moment going to try to suggest that I've got this figured out or am necessarily good at it, but learning to forgive somebody who has legitimately hurt you feels like death. And there are some times when I think that makes sense, and there are other times when it doesn't. But I've said this before, when Jesus brings death, he brings life. And with Jesus, when there is evil and true harm to each other, we have the opportunity for redemption and reconciliation. And so Paul will say, okay, if you have an, he says enemy, again, I don't know, be as generous or as broad as you need to be with that word or that category to make it fit your own experience. But if you have somebody in your life or there are people in your community like that, care for their needs. If they need something and you can provide it, do it. Now, is that hard? Yeah. Does it feel like death? Yeah. Do you want to? If I'm being honest, no, not really. I would rather crush my enemies and see them driven before me. But that's not the way of Jesus. And so the right off the bat, like, you can see some echoes of the fact that Paul truly does know or is aware of the teaching of Jesus. It's always weird because Paul doesn't really quote Jesus except for maybe, you know, once or twice, but his letters are riddled, just full of the ideas and the teaching that Jesus gave us. Things like turn the other cheek, pray for those who persecute you, blessed are those who grieve. This is all informing what Paul is writing. And if there's a community that can live together as a family and actually seek out and do that, there is probably nothing that will be able to stop them. Because it is a community that, by definition, is infused with the grace and presence of Jesus, that is truly acting as ambassadors of this resurrection life, an infinite second chances, unending grace and faithfulness from God for us. It is a natural result. And then he continues to talk about revenge, which is also kind of strange to me, because in one sense, like, to get revenge on an enemy or something like that, it's not always clear to me what that looks like in our modern day. Because when I think of revenge, I think of, like, I don't know, John Wick or something like that, which is weird because I've never even seen any of those movies. I just know what they're about. But the idea of, like, going and seeking revenge for somebody who harmed me, I'm not going to lie, there's something in my heart that resonates with that. And it's not the good part of my heart. The now deceased scholar Walter Wink will call it this. He says, it is the myth of redemptive violence. And by myth, he means the misunderstanding or this thing that we believe that is not true, that if we can use violence against those who have harmed us, it will redeem the situation. And that never works. Now, these are all, like, big concepts, like epic, sort of like the stuff of movies, the big movies. But I think more down to earth, we as just people will probably experience it more as we interact with, you know, human sandpaper. And if you don't know human sandpaper, you don't know anyone like that, I have bad news for you, because there's a chance. Fill in the blank. is that, you know, if somebody is, say, like, just yelling at you, just coming after you, the super critical, you know, ready to kind of let you have it, that sort of thing, I don't think I'm alone in having the experience of in the back of your head saying, oh no, saying that would be amazing. It's not going to make the situation better, but boy, it'll feel good. And then that other voice, I guess it's like the angel and demon on your shoulder, like from the old cartoons, saying, yeah, but if you say that, it's not going to fix anything, but it's going to feel really good if I say it. Hey, you shouldn't say it. It's going to, and then, and then you go, oh yeah, that made it so much worse. I am not even for a moment going to pretend I'm good at resisting that. But that's part of what Paul is trying to say. And there is a very subtle, very profound principle that is operating under this as we finish up our time together. When we take it on ourselves, as opposed to letting God work how God's going to work, when we, rather than follow the command to love those who are harming us, to actually take it on ourselves to put them in their place and let them have it, so on and so forth, there is a huge chance that we will become the evil that we are trying to address. And in fact, history itself is filled with people, powerful people, who in trying to address a certain kind of evil through any human means necessary and often violent means, they have unknowingly and unwittingly become the very evil they're trying to destroy. If Jesus, instead of going to his grave, decided, you know what, I'm going to pick a fight with the enemies of God, and here we go, he would have joined himself in a long history of people doing the same and it resulting in simply more violence. If we want to use those darker impulses within all of us to put somebody in their place or correct the problem, we will have then become the very problem we're trying to solve. Which is why Paul lands on the idea that we should just let God take care of it, because God is ultimately the one in charge. And when God acts, even when it feels like judgment and justice, it is still mercy. But then it's also why Paul gives us one of the most freeing things in this chapter, when he says, look, as much as it is up to you, live in peace with those around you. There is real freedom in that. How many times have you tried really hard to repair a relationship or address a problem or enter into some conflict and manage it as best and as wise as you are able, only to find that the other group or party or whatever is just not having it? Well, to that, Paul would say, in prayer and in God's grace, do what you can and be done. As much as it has been up to you, great. They are not yours to control. Now, again, please do not hear me say this as if I have this figured out. There's a danger in preaching where you can kind of come across like you actually are good at this stuff and you know it. No. And we'll just leave it at that. But I suspect I'm not the only one who struggles. And if we were to engage with Paul in dialogue about this section and say, yeah, but Paul, that's really hard. And Paul would say, that's the point. You know what it costs God to accomplish this? Jesus. It cost Jesus. And maybe that's the point. That's why he spent the first 11 chapters talking about what God has done in Jesus and what that means for us. About reforging our identity to be a community that is shaped like Jesus, that actually lives in a way that is sacrificial, that is willing to give up our rights for the sake of others' well-being. All of this feels like death. And maybe that's the point. Our community is one that is enriched and is fundamentally defined by the death and resurrection of Jesus. And what Paul is asking us to do is to engage in him in such a way that we live and operate within our relationships and our community in the same way. And there is real freedom in that, in living in the death and resurrection of Jesus. My prayer for us is that we continue to live and grow in that grace, to take the hit when we have to, for the sake of others, and as far as it is up to us, to live in peace with everybody we encounter, because all of that gives witness to this great and fundamental new reality that is based in resurrection. Amen.